Welcome to the Everyone's a Critic Movie Review Podcast. I'm your co-host, Bob Zarrell. With me, as always, is professional film critic, Sean Patrick. Visit us at ihatecritics.net, everyonesacriticpodcast.com, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Our handle there is Critics Pod. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Alexa, all your podcatchers. Ghana, I believe, is another one. YouTube, subscribe to the show, write and review the show, comment on the show if that platform allows it. We'll try to read as many of those as we can on the air if we remember. That's the key word. And then our TeePublic page at ihatecritics.net. Up in the right-hand corner, there's a TeePublic link if you want to get our merch. I'm sure there'll be a sale coming up here soon around the Christmas holidays, so if you want to get like 30% off, click on that link when the sale runs. We'll also put it on our social media page. And then patreon.com/criticspod. Patreon.com/criticspod is the best way to help support the podcast. And Sean, we have some upcoming Patreon stuff we're going to be doing.
That's right. We've got a couple of patron-specific episodes. They'll get a release eventually down the road, but they'll be just for the patrons early on. And that's going to be next week, a Thanksgiving bonus episode, a throwback to kind of a gimmick we used to do over Thanksgiving, movies you're thankful for. We're going to do a couple of those. And basically just a few movies, recent movies that we're both thankful for, and it'll be a positive episode where we talk about things we're happy about, and that's the perfect setup for the other bonus episode. I'm going into this one with an attitude, Bob. So I got a challenge on Twitter from a producer who was behind the I don't want to call it a reboot, but the repackaging, if you will, of I Spit on Your Grave, because I tweeted out my long ago review of I've Spit on Your Grave about the time that the sequel came out, and she'd somehow dug through my Twitter and found it. And she challenged me. She said, you should try watching it again. But with this new documentary and this new sequel and with these new commentaries, and fine, I'll go through this again. I'm happy to trash this movie. Yeah, no, I am going in with an attitude. I'm going to try and keep an open mind as much as I can and look at it through a new perspective. But honestly, I've hated this movie since I go back a long way, because Roger Ebert has always been my hero. And it was one movie where he talked about, which was one of the most negative reviews he ever wrote. And I thought, well, Roger's a little bit older than me. I got a better stomach than he does. I think I can handle this. And I watched it and I learned a valuable lesson that he was right. It was truly terrible. And I wrote about that fact. And I'm going to try it again. You know, it's been several years since I watched I Spit on Your Grave, and you know, the world has changed around this movie, and I don't think it's good. I think it'll probably make it worse, but I'm willing to look at it, and if it gets us a couple of hits down the road, so be it.
And I'll be honest, this is a movie I've always wanted to like. I've tried really hard to like it because it's supposed to be that cult horror movie that everybody, you know, it's that Last House on the Left, the one in Cannibal Holocaust that everybody talks about. And I try really hard. It's the filmmaking that usually takes it away from me. I don't mind the story as much. I know it's where we differ, Sean. But filmmaking is really bad. So that was why I always had a hard time getting into it.
It's funny, if you had told 25-year-old me that of those movies, which one I would come to realize was a classic, I never would have guessed it would be Cannibal Holocaust. But I'll defend that movie over any of that group. If I'm going to defend one, I'll defend Cannibal Holocaust.
Yeah, especially, you know, revisiting Texas Chainsaw Massacre and realizing how great that was. It definitely kind of made Last House fall to the side a little bit. I don't hate it, but it's definitely just not nearly as good as I thought it was when I first saw it. But yeah
if you want to know, I mean, just to reminisce about this show a little bit, just our reminisce about ourselves a little bit, I just, the greatest revelations of my life are, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre being a masterpiece and losing Crash.
Yeah.
Actually watching Crash for the first time.
Yeah, I'm proud of that moment. Well, then you throw in The Virgin Spring. That also kind of pushed Last House down too, a little bit. But I'm looking forward to it. I mean, it sounds like it's going to be a lot of work. We have how many commentary tracks do you have to watch?
Myers Archie and Joe Bob Briggs.
I've already seen the I saw the Joe Bob Briggs one, one before. So, and he does. I mean, I got what he was going for, but we'll talk about it then when we get there.
Yeah, and that'll be a Patreon bonus episode for Christmas. So there you go. Yeah, enjoy. Yeah. That'll be your Christmas present, patrons.
If we get
hearing
it done
me
by
cry
then.
About I Spit on Your Grave.
Watch you love it. That'd be amazing. we also have a new thing that kind of fell in our laps. We have a sponsor this week. It's the film Echo Boomers. They're going to give us a handful of digital releases to give away. But let me read the copy first. Michael Shannon stars in Echo Boomers, available now to buy or rent on digital. In this gripping crime thriller, a criminal operation made up of rebellious college graduates steal from the rich and give back to themselves. Also starring Patrick Schwarzenegger, Alex Pettifer, and Gillis Geary. There we go. Don't forget
Leslie Ann Warren.
Well, yeah, I haven't got that far yet, but they've phonetically spelled out those names, and then Leslie Ann Warren. buy or rent Echo Boomers and watch it tonight. It's rated R from Paramount Pictures. So they've given us a handful of digital releases. So if you go to our social media pages, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Critics Pod, or Everyone's a Critic Podcast on Facebook, if you like the picture and or comment on it, you'll be eligible for a digital giveaway. So all three platforms will be doing giveaways on each one of them separately. That's how many they've given us. So I'm kind of excited about this potential partnership. I think we have a couple more coming down the line that they might want to do with us as well. So
And I mean, I love Michael Shannon. That's the main reason why I would get behind something like this, is that Michael Shannon is, well, Michael Shannon. So there you go.
Yeah. And we won't be watching it till after the promo is over. I'm curious about Patrick Schwarzenegger as well. You know, it's always neat to see the second generation come through and see if they can pull off what their parents did. So we'll see how that plays out as well. But yeah, Echo Boomers, go to our social media pages, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Critics Pod. Find the picture of Echo Boomers. It's pinned to the top of all the pages except for Instagram, because they don't do that. And like it and put a comment, and you'll be entered to win a digital copy. All right, let's move on to our show. And we'll start with the movie in theaters right now, Ammonite. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, Ammonite. It's a kind of a rock formation that inside of it there's a fossil, if you will. Ammonite is a movie starring Kate Winslet and Saoirse Ronan, and it's an Academy Award contender. Basically, the story goes, and it's based off of a real woman, sort of. I'll get to that. Mary Anning is a real woman who is a famed archaeologist. She spent her life making these discoveries on the beach in England, and she actually, you know, there's this dinosaur called the Ichthyosaurus that we might not know exist without her, and that's a pretty great legacy to have. And she spent her life, you know, discovering these things, but of course, being a woman in the 19th century, she doesn't get the credit that she actually deserved for this stuff. And thus she was lived out her life in a very poor fashion. She was basically shining seashells on the seashore, which some actually claim that the poem "She Sells Seashells by the Seashore" is based off of her. There's no actual proof of that, but they think so, because that was kind of her life, was doing that, creating these seashell creations that she sold to tourists. She has a bit of a break in her life when she meets this man who wants to go out on a hunt for fossils with her. He's brought his wife with her, played by Saoirse Ronan. And when he leaves his wife behind to kind of convalesce in the sea air of this town where she lives. And he leaves her with Mary Anning. And after Saoirse Ronan gets sick, Kate Winslet takes care of her, nurses her back to health, and they begin to fall in love. And that's pretty much the story here, is told in a lot of, in a way that's kind of very familiar of this type of movie, where it's just told in a lot of glances and a lot of looks and sideways glances and that kind of stuff, where you can't really nobody says anything that's on their mind. They always just kind of imply it with a look. And, you know, you're getting a great performance out of Kate Winslet to deliver that. there's a remoteness to this movie that I can't quite connect with. Not the way there's a very similar era. It's very similar to Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which I think is a far better movie because it has a lot more passion and a lot more excitement. The passion in this movie doesn't arrive until quite late in the movie. And when it does, it is quite surprising because there's some, I don't know if I want to call it graphic, but there's certainly the sex scenes here are very explicit between Saoirse Ronan and Kate Winslet. And when you talk about stars this big, you don't necessarily expect to see what you see in this movie. And it is shocking and surprising and obviously compelling in that way. But by the time it arrives, though, and by the time that begins to happen, you know, much of the movie has been spent with you watching Kate Winslet polish rocks. And as great as she is, if you're somebody who's very triggered by the scraping of metal against rock, you're not going to enjoy this movie because they get very into the sound design on that. That became very difficult after a while. I appreciate a lot of this movie. I think I appreciate these two performances. I think they do communicate a depth of care for each other, and there's definitely a feeling between the two of them that they do well to capture. One of the major issues that I have is that in researching the movie, I can't find out if there's any actual evidence that Mary Anning was a lesbian. There's none of that. None of her past is very particularly well known. She apparently wasn't married and didn't have children, but that doesn't necessarily indicate that she is actually a lesbian. And I've got a little bit of a problem with people applying an actual backstory and life to somebody whose life is not that well known. I feel like there's an insidious quality to that, and I get trying to use homosexuality is a way to reveal her, basically like she's marginalized, like a gay person tends to be, and she's, you know, she's been mistreated, but you can get that from her just being a woman in the 1800s. You know, that's already a marginalized class. You're adding something else on top of that to try and communicate how marginalized she is. It doesn't quite work for me, and that aspect. Just trying to this sort of speculative fiction about whether or not she's gay or not. I just, there's something about it that I just don't care for. And that really holds me back from liking this movie a lot.
Yeah. When you texted me and said you were still recovering from it, I think I misunderstood what you were talking about. I thought you meant the whole movie. So, I went and read into it because it sounded appealing. And that was a lot of people seem to be torn on that part right there. Most of the critics, whether it's, you know, obviously we don't know if it's true or not. And I read up what the director had come up with, and the main reason he did it was just because usually when you don't hear about a past of somebody, that means they're, I guess usually is not even the right word, but they're never going to tell you if someone from that era was gay or not or homosexual or not.
Right.
And so he thought it'd be okay to do what he did. And not having seen it, I have no idea how I would feel about it. I do know that the sex scenes were choreographed by Kate Winslet and Saoirse Ronan, not by the director, which was probably what makes what you're saying that much more. I don't know what the word is. I was going to say incredible, or weird. I don't know which one is which. But regardless, it sounds like that was a highlight of the movie, apparently. And I'm not saying that
from a prurient interest. Yes,
right. That's what
I would be. I would honestly, if I was watching this in a theater, it's to a level where I'd be quite uncomfortable, and I find that funny because this movie actually debuted at a drive-in recently at a drive-in at a festival. I can't even imagine what that must be like to watch it in drive-in,
especially if there's cars that can drive by if there's a road nearby. But I mean, I have no idea. I haven't seen it. I don't know what it is, but I don't know. I am curious. I don't know if that's enough to make me go watch it or not, but we'll see. And then, you know, you always hear I could listen to this actor read out of a phone book. I'd pay to do that. Well, you could pay to watch Kate Winslet scrape rocks. And then when that starts happening, do you actually want to? That's what, you always run into that.
Eddie Izzard, the great stand-up comedian, had this bit about describing British movies back in the day. It was just a guy sitting in a room counting matches, and somebody else walks in and goes, "Oh, you're here. Yes, I'm here." And they just stare at just sort of this awkward tension while the person just continues to count matches. And that's kind of what Ammonite is all it really is. It's like somebody walks into a room and goes, "Oh, yes, okay, yes." And they just kind of look at each other. and look, and they just kind of look away, and then they look at each other. Everything is deeply implied, but nothing is said. And then she just continues to scrape rocks.
Now, every review I've read about this mentioned the tongue twister. Do they at all mention that? Because you mentioned it too. Did you just find that in your research?
No mention of it. It's really just the only thing that mentions it really is her Wikipedia. And if you look up her Wikipedia, they say that there's no real evidence that it was about her, only that it makes sense that it would be.
Sounds like the whole plot of this movie. All right. Anything else before we move on?
No.
Antebellum.
Antebellum came out earlier this year. It was supposed to be a theatrical release. Obviously, they shifted it to the digital release, the $20 release, and finally, it's down to a price that you and I are willing to pay to see it. that's basically the backstory of that. No, it stars Janelle Monáe as a woman named Veronica, who's a successful author who, through some means, finds herself back in the Antebellum South. Antebellum meaning pre-Civil War. Which pre-Civil, I guess it's just as the Civil War is starting, but I guess the title is supposed to be a joke because we're kind of in an antebellum time now where it appears like we're on the verge of another Civil War.
Yeah.
Which I get that. Somebody had to explain it to me, but I got it. I don't know. This movie has a big twist to it. I'm conflicted on whether or not to reveal the twist because I don't think this is a very good movie because of the twist. I think it's pretty lame, especially when the marketing had already set it up to be like a sci-fi sort of thing, and it's not. And how it's not is kind of dumb. The yeah. whole movie is kind of dumb in the same way. Janelle Monáe is fine. She definitely communicates the strength and intensity, and there's the particular elements of direction here that really work, like some visual elements. The cinematography is very crisp and clear, and there's a couple of really great shots that it could be like, if this were a really great movie, you could look at a couple of them and go, that's an iconic shot that people would remember for decades. Like a group of characters gets lit on fire in a building and Janelle Monáe is walking away from the building. It's cool. Yeah. That's cool. That's a great looking scene. You could slap that on a poster. It'd be awesome. But none of the rest of the movie really works. You've got the bad guys here played by Eric Lang and Jack Houston and Jenna Malone. And none of them are really characters. No. They're all really these broad caricatures of the South and without really great villains. Like, what, you know, they talked about this movie as from the producers of Get Out was the big tagline for this mm-hmm. movie, the big sell. And what that movie had was as much as it had great villains. Right. They really were great villains in that movie. Bradley Whitford and Catherine Keener and Williams. They were all just terrific villains. They really sold the evil of that and made you feel it. And they you couldn't really call them characters of depth, but they had enough depth to make it work, especially because the movie's not about them. It's about Daniel Kaluuya. This movie has no depth to those characters. You know, Jack Houston's character is basically just the biggest Southern fried Civil War caricature of all time. Just a broad accent is basically who he is. We're told that the character played by Eric Lang is a senator. But that really, there's no impact to that. There's really no, we don't see him in the other, you know, aspects of the movie outside of the aspect of the Civil War. And there's a really, there's probably a pretty interesting way to tell that story with him, you know, becoming a character and him, you know, they're a more insidious notion. But this movie often hints at better ideas, like Jenna Malone character talks about Janelle Monáe's daughter in the movie, and that opens up a potential for something scary or terrifying or, you know, another kind of twist that they don't explore. Nothing ever comes of that. And that's really a lot of what Antebellum is just a lot of things adding up to absolutely nothing.
Yeah, that's a pretty good way of explaining it. And really, if this movie was anything like Get Out, or we would have heard the buzz and we probably would have found a way to spend the money to see it sooner. Is my guess, because this was really, it's hard because literally everything about it is great except for the story. The story throws it all away. And I mean, those characters, the reason there's no depth is because if they have depth, the twist doesn't exist. You know, you know about it from the get-go. And it's, man, it's frustrating because you want it. To me, it's like Interstellar where it's everything about it is so perfect. And then you just, the story is so bad that you want to like the movie, but you end up hating it more than you should. At least that's how it is for me. I thought Janelle Monáe was fantastic. I thought the look of it was great. Everything about it, everything was great. And I just kept waiting for something, like not really knowing where it was going to go. And it, even really, I never was invested in the story from the get-go, but I liked everything else about it so much that I kept waiting for the story to go somewhere to surprise me or do something. And then when the surprise came, I'm like, really? That was, I don't even, one, I don't buy it. Two, it's weak. Right. So I don't know. Disappointing is the big word I can use for it, but it should have been great.
Yeah, it's really, it is a disappointing movie. And how soon did you figure out the twist?
I want to say, I mean, I had an idea pretty early. Plus, the movie's been out for a while, so I think I'd kind of heard something anyway. So it's hard to honestly give you an answer because I had kind of had an idea going in.
Yeah.
But I don't know. How early did you figure it out?
I think I got it about the time that they were burning the cotton. I thought, that's odd.
Yeah.
And then it kind of occurred to me, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Right. Yeah, it's just, I don't know, just really kind of a bummer. Because it looked good. Everybody in it is good. It's just a bad movie. And that sucks. Anything else before we move on?
No, not really.
All right. How about The Giant?
The Giant, as I continue a tour of movies I don't care for. The Giant stars Odessa Young as Charlotte, a woman who's a young girl, teenager, getting out of high school. She's dealing with, about a year ago, her mother committed suicide in a rather public fashion, and she's been dealing with that. Her boyfriend, Joe, has left town and not long after her mother killed herself and just not looked back. And she's kind of trying to live up to, you know, the expectations of a high school teenager and, you know, going on with her life and doing fun things you're supposed to do as you're ending your high school career. But something keeps nagging at her. I don't know if it's a series of dreams or whatnot, but fuck it. The whole movie's a fucking dream. It really is. It's so annoying. I just hate this movie. It should be good because there are elements here there are elements of solid filmmaking, of, you know, ideas that are reminiscent of like The Neon Demon or you know, similarly dreamlike movies. But this one doesn't really have enough of an idea behind it to actually work. And I don't think necessarily the director had a point or purpose of what he was getting to. It's supposed to be kind of a serial killer movie where you've got a bad guy who's killing young girls about her age, and she might be connected to them. It might be her ex-boyfriend. It might be her ex-boyfriend's friend. But I've seen this movie. I couldn't begin to tell you who the bad guy is. Just couldn't begin to tell you who the bad guy is. No idea. And I've seen the movie, and the movie, they're just dicking around the whole time, and they don't really give you anything to work with in the end. And yeah, I just don't think this is a very good movie.
I thought about watching it this morning, and then I read your review, and I said, yeah, I'm going to save my $6. And the next movie we're going to talk about, I read your review as well. Didn't watch it. Bullets of Justice.
Oh, yeah. Bullets of Justice stars Danny Trejo. Well, no, it don't, because he's just a cameo. I'm not sure where this movie comes from. It's a foreign film of some sort. Might be from Russia, translated into English somehow, via Danny Trejo, maybe. I don't know. This is a weird movie. It's set in some future time where pig-human hybrids have taken over the world and enslaved humanity and are using humanity for food. And the last human outpost has a hero who is a bounty hunter, and he kills pig men to as a bounty hunter. I don't know how he can be a bounty hunter in a world you don't control anywhere, but never mind. Doesn't matter. He's got a series of female assistants who he has sex with a lot, and then they get killed. Once his most recent assistant gets killed, he teams up with his sister, who has a mustache, who he also sleeps with regularly. He also has these visions of a traitor, this guy who's turned sides and works for the pigmen, who also happened to be this guy's rival when he was competing to have the greatest ass on Earth, and he lost to this guy, and this guy's now also a bounty hunter, but for the other side. And he wears just a cock sock the whole movie. That the other guy just wears, that's all he wears, is a cock sock the whole movie, and just shows off his admittedly fantastic ass the whole time. This is a comedy, I guess, but it's never particularly funny. It's mostly just pornographic extreme grossness. There's a character in the movie that is given the name Benedict Asshole. And it's not because he's a traitor. It's because he literally has an anus where his mouth should be. And one of our lead character, when he thinks that Benedict Asshole has been killed and he's been brought the head of Benedict Asshole, he sticks his finger in his mouth, in the anus on his face, and then tastes it. And then says, "This is not Benedict Anus." That's the joke. You're not laughing, Bob. Why aren't you laughing?
Because I kind of figured they'd go there. I knew where the joke was going to go when you started telling the story. So that's.
I can get down with an extreme movie. I made fun of, I was talking about I Spit on Your Grave before and how I'm not a fan of that movie. But I liked Martyrs, and I respect Martyrs, and I think that's an extreme movie. And Night of the Virgin is an extreme movie, undoubtedly, filled with all sorts of intense, gross-out stuff. And I think that movie is a masterpiece. So I can get down with this grindhouse stuff. I really can, but not when it's this stupid. This reminded me of a 13-year-old boy writing a comic book and just coming up with the things that are going to, make his friends laugh and maybe put off his parents. And that's great if you're 13 years old, but it's not so great if you're an adult having to suffer through this. And I don't understand the impulse of an adult to want to enjoy this.
When you compared it to a trauma movie, that's when I knew I was out. Because I don't get it. I can get the grindhouse stuff to an extent. I can, I'll watch, Eli Roth's History of Horror thing, and I'll listen to Tarantino talk about all these bad movies that he thinks are great, which I watched one last night, and I don't know why he thought it was great. Wolf Creek was one I went and saw because Rodriguez and Tarantino loved, and I haven't seen it since then. I loved it at the time, but I slept for at least 45 minutes of the movie. And
Wolf Creek is utter garbage,
and I haven't gone back to it. And from what I hear, everybody says it's garbage. But regardless, it's there. I don't know what it is. If it's just the, and the weird thing is, the movie I watched was The Devil Plus Five, and then another movie they talked about was Pieces, and they kept using it in the same breath as Texas Chainsaw Massacre because they all came out at the same time. Mm-hmm. And this is just—it's really boring. It's not well made, and the murders are weird. But at the same time, there's nothing conventional about it, and there's no, you can tell the studio's not involved. So I don't know if that's what they love about these movies. I don't understand it. But at least I can appreciate those more than the trauma stuff. The trauma stuff is just so, it's like even Roger Corman does more fun than that. They know what they're doing, and it's just kind of, it's made for themselves and their friends and nobody else. And I just never could get into it. I can appreciate a good B movie, but the trauma stuff is just, I don't get.
Trauma has always struck me as a group of people who made movies just for themselves and just so they can point at other people and go, "You don't get it. See how funny this is? You don't get it." And it's like, no, I don't. I'm okay with not getting it. Go away, you creep.
Yeah, I mean, I remember watching like the Toxic Adventure cartoon and not, you know, I mean, not loving it, but just being like, okay, this is a decent character. And then they, I think there's one that came out since we've done this podcast, and I turned it on and I was like, within 10 minutes, I was like, I can't watch this. This is bad. I mean, it's just god awful bad. It's not even fun bad. Okay, anything else on Bullets of Justice, or should we move on?
I mean, do you have any questions for me about this cinematic masterpiece?
No, it's it sounds like complete garbage. And I mean, part of me thought maybe I should watch it to be the other voice, but I watched the trailer and I was like, no, this, I mean, when you said trauma in your review, that definitely, it looks like it comes from that lane, and I don't enjoy that lane very much.
I imagine this comes from a country where they've only ever seen trauma movies, and they think this is just what movies are.
And in the trailer, you know how Danny Trejo dies apparently early on? They show it in the trailer.
They do, yes.
They tell you, I'm like, why would you even, like, he's on your poster, because he's the only recognizable face. Why would you do that? Anyway, we've given them a lot of time. Before we get to the next movie you watched, I just want to mention, I did see Chick Fight. My wife kind of forced it on me. It looked really good, and she enjoyed it. And it actually wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. It stars Malin Ackerman and Bella Thorne. It's kind of a... they definitely rip off Rocky a lot. It's about this character, Anna. She has... her car gets repossessed. She finds out her dad's gay, and that her... or they, her dad's dating somebody after her mom just died and happens to be gay. That's not really an issue with her. It's just the fact that he's dating somebody else, and that her coffee shop burns down. And so her friends take her to this female fight club thing, and she has no fighting experience. She starts getting trained by Alec Baldwin, who trained Sugar Ray, and... learned us how to fight. Bella Thorne.
Mark McGrath, Sugar Ray, right?
That's the twist at the end. Thanks for spoiling the movie.
Wow, I did not watch this movie.
I mean, I'm not going to pretend like I didn't think it, but then, you know, they watch clips of, I don't know if they watch Sugar Ray, but they talk about Sugar Ray, the fighter. And then when it is a twist, I mean, he's just drunk the whole time. Alec Baldwin's having a blast. I mean, yeah. This is a movie that we wouldn't have seen. I wouldn't have seen otherwise, probably other than the pandemic. Probably similar to Bullets for Justice. However, it's actually halfway fun. Kevin Nash kind of steals the show, playing her gay dad. And maybe it's that I'm not as woke as I think I am. And maybe it's more offensive than it really appears. But he's having fun with it. But it's more about the Fight Club, and Fortune Feimster and Dulce Sloan are really good friends of Malin Ackerman's character, and Bella Thorne's the big bad guy, and they rip off Rocky, like I said. Malin Ackerman's character, Anna, can take punches. That's her big strength. The way they end it is very similar to Rocky II. And then there's even the Rocky III moment where her and her friend have that final punch in the ring. So it was a lot of Rocky ripoff. But it really isn't that bad. It's kind of fun. It's definitely not worth renting unless you're into that demographic that would like this movie. But if you are, it's you'll be surprised at how good. I would argue it's the best movie we've talked about other than maybe Ammonite, because I don't know what that is.
Christy LeMire, who's a very good film critic, did a review of this and called it the worst movie of the year.
That's lazy. There's no way. Antebellum's worse than this. It's way better made. I mean, this is just, it's not trying.
To be fair, Christy LeMire doesn't have to see Bullets of Justice. So.
Right. And it's easy to say. I mean, I remember Ebert talking about how you can't possibly say Crash is worse than Deuce Bigelow, European Gigolo. Yes, I can.
Yeah, I can too.
And that's the kind of thing. This is more on that. It's a step above that level, but it's not. It's really not that bad. And it's kind of fun. It's coherent. So that's enough on that. We don't got to spend any more time on that. My wife liked it a lot more than I did. But it was I'm a big Kevin Nash fan, so it was kind of fun to see him having a blast. Survival Skills
is a unique movie. This is basically a parody film, but it's not necessarily a comedy parody movie. So you think of parody, you think of Naked Gun, you think of, you know, Blazing Saddles, you think of, you know, just that type of setup. This is, would be a setup of police procedural training videos. But the thing is that this movie isn't particularly funny, and it's not trying to be particularly funny. The idea here is that this cop has just taken his first job, a full-time job in the force, and he's the subject of a training video where he's going through police training on his first day out, and all these horrific things happen, and he's trying to remain positive and remain happy while Stacy Keach is narrating the whole thing and talking about the various challenges the police face and the procedures they must follow in order to survive these things and to work through these situations. It is fascinating in so many different ways. I was talking in my review, and people are going to get triggered by this, so prepare yourselves. Defund the police is something that's been talked about a lot. And I think this movie actually makes the case for it in a way that I don't think any documentary could do quite as well. Basically, the idea here is that this poor cop who's on his first job, he ends up going on a domestic disturbance call his first time out. And he becomes sort of not just a police officer. He has to be a counselor. He has to be every aspect of this that you would think would be handled by six different people to help somebody who's in trouble has to be handled by this guy. And because the system is so broken and set up so poorly that everything falls on this guy. And granted, he takes a lot of it on himself, but if he doesn't, nobody else will. And this woman and her child will stay in this abusive situation. And it just puts the lie to the idea that it's not about you know, that we don't trust police officers to do their job or trust them to be able to handle any situation. It's that they're put in a situation where they have to, if they're going to play out a scenario to its most best possible outcome, it kind of has to be something like this where they're involved the whole way through. And that's just not even possible with all the things that police officers already have to do. And this makes the case that if perhaps we had other agencies that were also police agencies or police-like agencies that could handle specific situations like domestic disturbances or so on, that maybe we could have better outcomes in these situations and save more people and help more people. That's really what Defund the Police is all about. It's not about we're just going to eliminate police departments and go on, you know, with chaos, which is just the stupid, you know, talking point that people on the right want to make about defund the police, which they're just pretending not to understand the issue. And this movie is not directly about that, but it makes the case better than that because it shows you exactly what would have to happen for him to play out this outcome to if there's going to be a good outcome. And there's not going to be because there really is no good outcome when you're the one person who's trying to handle all this and you're also trying to do your job every day and handle other cases. And it's really fascinating and dark and mysterious and funny. And I just love Stacy Keach is in this, doing the narration, who's constantly kind of flustered by this guy who keeps going off the script. The main cop guy, he keeps leaving the story and kind of going off on his own and trying to do more than what he's trying to work outside of the training and do more to help people. And Stacy Keach is trying to explain, no, this is how you're trained to do it. And this is the only way to do it. And if you try to do it any other way, bad things happen. And he's right, but at the same time, what else could you do in this scenario if you're a good person who's seeing something terrible happen? I'm fascinated by this movie. It's also inspired by a documentary that has become very infamous online over the decades called Surviving Edged Weapons. And that's a whole story in itself where it's a 1980s cop training thing that basically is just a big scare tactic just intended to make you terrified of the entire world, especially if any time you encounter an edge weapon, which granted, anytime you're confronted by a knife, you'd probably be afraid. But this takes it to a degree that is rather nonsensical and is also hugely gross and graphic. Do not watch it. If you have a if you don't have a stomach for it, because it shows real life dead bodies who have been who suffered knife wounds. Really disturbing stuff. And I think Quinn Armstrong has created something here that is powerful and important and dark and disturbing, and most interestingly takes the parody genre and uses it in a way that I don't think anybody has ever used parody before. And that's really what makes this movie so fascinating.
Yeah, it looks fascinating. It comes out December 4th. I'm looking forward to seeing it. I did try to watch that Surviving Edged Weapons or whatever it is. I just keep falling asleep before it gets quote unquote good. So I don't know.
You didn't see the graphic knife wounds?
I saw certain, I think, I mean, I'm in various stages of sleep when I'm seeing it, so I don't even know what is real and what's in my imagination, so I can't.
A lot of it is just like reenactments, terrible, awful reenactments, yes, of encounter with you know, these street punks played by amateur cops,
right,
acting out what they think punks sound like on the streets, and that's hilarious. That's the funny part. But then they actually go into the actual. They've got these guys telling stories about how they were stabbed and where they were stabbed and what happened after they were stabbed and showing off their wounds. And then they show, you know, actual dead bodies with knife wounds. And it's just this bizarre fever dream of a thing that you can't even imagine was shown to cops, but was in the late 1980s as a way of training them. And this is how we train police. And that's another thing, is that the way we train police officers is not to deal with these types of situations where there's highly charged emotions and maybe you don't know who's right and who's wrong. Now, granted, you know who's wrong in a domestic disturbance. The person who's hurting the other person is completely wrong. But what if it's just an accusation and it's just two people having an argument?
Right.
And it's gone to a degree that's, you know, desperately emotional and could turn violent. Who's supposed to deal with that? Right. And we are asking our cops to deal with that, and they shouldn't have to. We should have people who are trained for that. And we don't train cops for that. We're training cops right now in this fashion that is desperately militaristic. And we keep funding these things for, especially in big cities, where we're buying them, you know, massive military weaponry. And when really, you know, what could be better is just for somebody to have a conversation with somebody.
Well, yeah, and even the militaristic part of it isn't. It's not as in depth as the military, though. So either, so they're not fully trained that direction either way.
Yeah.
And this is, I mean, what I saw is definitely a fear-based approach to training, and that is not healthy at all.
Absolutely not.
Anything fear-based is not the way to go. But again, I'm also just a guy on the streets, and it's a frustrating conversation to have because it's apples and oranges, because defund a police means something to one person, means something totally different to somebody else.
Yes.
And it's a stupid name, and there's a way to do it. There's a way to talk about it. Plus, you can't count on police officers to police themselves. It's not, you can't trust anybody to police themselves, really. So you should have different organizations to take care of each other. But that is what it is. I'm not, it's just a frustrating conversation.
It is.
Should we move on to our classic?
Sure.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the main event for the linear, legitimate, and universally recognized, undisputed
classic.
Dirty Harry.
Dirty Harry stars Clint Eastwood, directed by Don Siegel, and it stars Eastwood as Dirty Harry Callahan, a detective in San Francisco who plays by his own rules. We're told that, and then we watch it demonstrated. Then we're told that, and we watch it demonstrated, and it's just, oh, what a bad movie. I mean, just truly, this is a bad movie. Eastwood's completely on autopilot. He's acting this as if he doesn't think it's going to be that big a hit. Then when it's kind of like, it feels like a default for him. I'll just knock this out and it'll be something I did and it'll be over with and I can move on to other things. And then it becomes this massive, monstrous hit that people love, and he's got to go back and do it repeated times. Not that he doesn't want to, but that I just don't feel like his heart was in it, at least not this first one. I don't recall the other movies, although this one ends in a way that makes me kind of wonder if he actually did have plans for a sequel. But the idea here is that he is a plays by rules, and because of that, he ends up, you know, basically letting a killer loose to steal a bus full of children because he doesn't know how to follow the rules.
You can word it that way.
Everything that happens is entirely his fault. Yeah. Everything happens in this movie is entirely his fault. He screws up repeatedly. He's the worst cop. He's like Leslie fucking Nielsen in Naked Gun at times when he's making all the mistakes that he makes.
And he seems shocked that he makes them. Like he didn't know, I can't do that. It's like, clearly you're not a 20-something. You're a veteran on the force. Right. Oh, I don't have to read Miranda rights? And I mean, knowing what it is and kind of the genre that it plays in, I get who likes this and why they like it. I'm not as troubled by it. But at the same time, it's like it's not on that Die Hard Lethal Weapon level. It's not that much fun. It's just slightly above that Death Wish level, I guess. And there's a big gap there between the Lethal Weapon Die Hard to the, you know, Dirty Harry Death Wish era mm-hmm. of cop movies.
Because this one is not self-aware. I would argue that Lethal Weapon is aware yes. of how broad and comic it is.
Yes.
And there's no awareness of that here. Like, Eastwood is not in on the joke when he's walking around with a bullet wound in his leg and it's not affecting him in any way. Like he feels no pain. Like he's, you know, like he's got a wooden leg or something and there's a bullet lodged in it. Like he's got no self-awareness whatsoever. And that, you know, this movie is remembered for that famous scene. Do you feel lucky, punk, and all that stuff. And when you watch that scene, can you tell me exactly what purpose that scene serves in the rest of the movie? Because I'll argue that it means absolutely nothing. It has absolutely nothing to do with the rest of the narrative. It tells us nothing that we didn't already hear in the previous two scenes. We're introduced to Harry Callahan prior to that scene, but with scenes that indicate that he's a guy who plays outside, who plays by his own rules sometimes, you know, and is a guy who causes trouble. So, and we've also been told that he's a very good detective. And so, having a scene where he observes this bank robbery about to happen and then acts on it in a way that is, you know, violent and destructive and, you know, playing by his own rules. It's basically reiterated information that we've already been given to him about him. So the scene is redundant on top of being completely unnecessary to the rest of the plot. And yet it's become this iconic scene that people remember for years and years, to the point where they actually repeat this same dialogue at the end because they know that they've got something that they think is so cool that we need to do it again because that's why people will remember it.
I just wonder if it's some cold-blooded shit he says to his victims. That's all I could. Literally, that's all it could be because it doesn't matter to the rest of the movie. I mean, as a movie, you're right. If you deconstruct it, it's full of mistakes and problems. As intense scenes, sure, they work here and there. But at the same time, you have to realize that this is an hour longer than it needed to be because he really caught the guy. Had he done it right, it would have been over halfway through. So, but, yeah.
You just I got to say... There's a scene where they have the bad guy's taken a 14-year-old girl and he's hidden her away somewhere and he wants them to pay the ransom for her. That whole sequence goes on forever, about 40 minutes of the movie, and ends with them showing the naked body of what they say is a 14-year-old girl. And I'm sorry, once you've established that the character is 14 years old, you're not allowed to show her naked. That's just beyond the pale. You're just being gratuitous and gross and exploitative, and it really made me hate this movie that much more.
Yeah, up until the bus driver came into it, I feel like every woman that was in this was either in a bikini or naked at some point.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Eastwood has got this thing about threesomes. It's very creepy. He did it in The Mule, as recently as The Mule, where he's making, you know, these creepy jokes about, you know, like there's a scene where they're supposed to be monitoring for the bad guy and he's got some binoculars and he just starts watching this, of course, as women do, you know, answering the door nude, like all women do when their friends come over and to get ready to apparently have sex with each other. That's all that women do.
Yeah, I know it's not true because I've tried to get my wife to do that. She will not do that. Yeah, but that is something that it is weird. But I mean, it's just, Yeah, it's totally gratuitous, all of it. Literally every piece of nudity in this movie is gratuitous.
And I can tell you that I can tell for absolutely certain that Eastwood does not care what he's doing in this movie, because we've just seen White Hunter Black Heart, where we're watching him give this deeply charismatic and unique performance where he is deeply invested in this character and giving it his everything and still being, you know, kind of, he's still being, you know, politically incorrect or whatever you want to call it, however you want to describe him. But he definitely cares about portraying this character, and you sense the care that he has for it, and he's deeply invested in it, and he's charismatic and he's interesting. And here he's so flat and so monotone in everything that he does. You can just sense that he doesn't care about this.
The most frustrating part is that the iconic scene you talk about, whether it's the beginning or the end, either one of those scenes, the parody versions are better. You know, because they're pulling the Western Clint Eastwood. They're using his tone, and they're saying, "Do you feel lucky, punk?" And the way they're doing it is so much more creepy and dark than he doesn't. I mean, he just kind of says it, and it's not nearly as cool as like when Jim Carrey does it or anybody else who's ever. I mean, it's been done a million times. So much better than this movie. It was just kind of a letdown.
You know what else bugged me about that scene is that you can sense off screen that Don Siegel had told the punk, the black guy who's on the other end of the first scene, to, you can definitely tell him, he told him to act more black. And it's so, that's just so screwed up. Like, you can just, I was just having that Robert Townsend Hollywood Shuffle version of that scene in my head, where he's like, just say it. No, say it more black. Say it more black.
Don't say I gotta know. Say I gots to know.
I gots to know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is what it is. I mean, I get why people like, I don't even know if my dad likes it, but I get why people like my dad would like a movie like this, but it's if you really deconstruct it, it's kind of a mess. And
really is a knucklehead. I mean, he really is a terrible cop in the end.
Well, yeah, a 50-year-old veteran should know that you have to read Miranda rights, or however old he is, 50 or 40, right. Whatever he is, he definitely isn't 20. And
I mean, the one you know, thing that I can actually say for him is that he didn't shoot first in the opening, you know, the battle against the bank robbers. At least he didn't shoot first. that's about the most cop, the good cop thing he does in the entire movie.
Well, then they try to make him, the reason they call him Dirty Harry is because he hates everyone. Well, then later on they decide it's because he does all the dirty work, and it's just kind of lame because it's like, I don't know. I don't even know where I'm going. It was just, the whole part was lame, the way they went about it. And, you know, just, I don't know. It's,
and just gratuitous, like, unnecessary racism on top of it. Just throwing that in for no good reason. Well, he's Dirty Harry because he hates everybody. And he hates this group and this group and this group, using expletive this, expletive that.
Right.
Just no reason for it. There's no necessity to do that. They just do it because, I don't know, does being a racist make him cool? I'm not sure what that exists for.
Well, and then it turned out that's not why they call him Dirty Harry. You know, in the end, they later on get rid of. So it's like that scene is totally unnecessary. It's just kind of a mess. I thought the bad guy was pretty over the top and fun. You know, you put him, like, I could see a Nicolas Cage doing something like that and having a blast with it. But
he kind of looked like Malcolm McDowell.
I sometimes when he goes over the top, Clockwork Orange, like, he was kind of in a lot of ways the best part of the movie. But yeah, just kind of overlong because of stupidity, and it's a shame. But I was expecting to hate it way more than I did.
I hated it about as much as I thought I might.
I mean, I guess it is watchable, I suppose, especially for a certain demographic. Maybe that's troubling, but it's still watchable for those people.
Why can't the cops just do whatever they want? Because here's why. Watch this fucking movie.
But that whole scene with the DA.
What a crappy scene. Because here's this guy who's just being incredibly reasonable, and he's being played as the villain.
They're all on the same side. And he's Dirty Harry is so confused why what he did was wrong. It's like, he broke into a guy's house without a warrant. Then you didn't greet him his rights on top of that. Everything's inadmissible. Oh, man. Anyway, that's Dirty Harry.
There was no necessity for it either. His buddy goes, should we call for a warrant? I mean, you call for a warrant, what are you waiting, like a half an hour, hour?
Right. I have no idea.
For a little bit, and then you still arrest the guy at his house. Like, you know.
I mean, if he's there now, he's going to be there tomorrow or whenever you end up doing it. You know?
So yeah, just pretend you don't know where he lives.
Right.
Keep a tail on him, get your warrant, arrest him. No, we need to do it now. I guess, the girl was being held underground, allegedly, that they had to do it. That was his reasoning for having to do it quickly. But that still doesn't give you the right to violate the law.
Right. And then be
surprised by it that nothing what you did is admissible.
Really, the surprise factor was the problem more than anything else. I mean, I could see John McClane or Martin Riggs doing that. But they wouldn't be surprised when they got in trouble later on.
Yeah.
All right. Home Alone turned 30. What are your thoughts on Home Alone?
Still holds up for me. I mean, as a broad, silly family movie, this is still kind of funny to me. And I think the violence of this movie is very, you know, in the vein of a Bugs Bunny movie. And I enjoyed that. I enjoy the notion of, you know, Joe Pesci as Elmer Fudd. That works perfect for me. They're kind of both Elmer Fudd, him and Daniel Stern. And it's as if they really can't be harmed. They're like cartoon characters. And if you think about it like that, I think it really does still remain very, very funny.
Yeah, I watched it probably 30 times last year because my son fell in love with it all over again. it works. If we wanted to deconstruct it like Dirty Harry, yes, they would have died and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, some movies don't make you do that. Dirty Harry gets you to a point where you just start, you kind of fall out of it, especially after so many years. You fall out of the movie and you start tearing it apart. This keeps you invested in the movie, so you're not doing that. And that's a tribute to this movie. I think of Macaulay Culkin. He's got chemistry. He's great. It's a fun movie.
Yeah, he's easy to enjoy. He's easy to like. He reminded me of myself when I was his age, you know, wanting to be home alone and running around. I was left home alone a lot, so I recognize a lot of what he wants to do there before all the, you know, the violence kicks in.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, it's fun. It reminds me of my son in ways, and obviously I can't see anybody doing this for real, but it's fun. It's a fun little fantasy, and Rambo got to live it out in the latest Rambo movie. Speaking of Rambo, Rocky V came out 30 years ago as well.
Did it? Oh, wow. I totally forgot about that one.
Yeah, it's very popular phrase when you talk about the Rocky movies. Oh, I forgot about that one.
Which one is Rocky V? What does he do in this one? Is this
Rocky V is the one where they brought John Avildsen back to direct it, and he was going to try again. It wasn't going to be the fun movie like 3 and 4. He was going to try to make a serious movie. Rocky loses everything, and he fights Tommy Gunn and ends up just kind of being a snooze fest. It's no fun. It's just kind of, it's just Cats in the Cradle and not even that good. So, I don't know.
Well, hiring Tommy Morrison was a really great idea.
Yeah.
So, the kid poured charisma.
Yeah. It's just, I don't know. He's trying too hard to be... This is the era of Stallone where he didn't realize what he was. Like, he wasn't in on the joke anymore.
Yeah.
And... I don't know. He did a way better job with Rocky Balboa, and obviously with the Creed movies, it really didn't involve him other than his acting. He did a better job there than he does here. This is just kind of a mess, and it's boring, and it's probably his worst performance is Rocky, where you're kind of laughing at how bad he is.
Yeah, when Rocky going back to the neighborhood is so lame.
It doesn't really work that way.
Yeah.
And yeah, it just, I don't know. The consistency between the movies is so out there. And that's why Creed is so impressive, because somehow it tears down all the inconsistencies all these movies had and just pulls it into this really tight movie, and it makes you kind of buy into the whole series. And I don't know. I was just really impressed with the way they did that, and I just want to forget Rocky V.
Amen.
Have you seen Rescuers Down Under recently?
Not since I was like 14 years old when it came out.
Yeah, me too.
I didn't go to the theater or anything, but I recall watching it with kids younger than me.
Oddly enough, of these three, that's the only one I saw in the theater, thanks to my parents. I didn't get to see either one. I mean, I remember even when Rocky V came out, I was watching it for a while, and I just kind of left and went outside to play football by myself. And then my dad felt bad because Rocky V is all about how he avoids his kid, and he started playing catch with me. That's how I remember Rocky V.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, that's our show. Next week,
while Bob processes his relationship with his father, we move on.
It was fun. Got to play catch. Next week, we got Fat Man, Unhinged, New Mutants, and Run. Possibly more, possibly less. We'll see. Our classics.
Possibly Josh.
Josh seems to be on board to come back. Our class is going to be Blazing Saddles, and he's coming back because in 30 years ago, Dances with Wolves came out. Why he's so attached to that movie, we'll find out. We've been giving him a hard time since the day he started this podcast on that movie. I'm not looking forward to watching it.
Don't forget the greatest action movie of all time.
The sequel to the greatest action movie of all time, Predator all right. 2. Another movie. I haven't seen Blazing Saddles. I haven't seen Predator 2. But I have seen Three Men and a Little Lady, which turns 30 as well. So it's going to be a jam-packed show.
Man, yeah. Think of it like this. Murtaugh fights a predator.
I like Murtaugh.
There you go.
Do they call him Roger?
Don't think they do. But it's set in Los Angeles, so.
All right. Well, I'm interested, if nothing else. If I remember right, isn't there some sort of ode to the Alien movies in this?
Yes, yes. Yes, there is.
Great. I hope it's good.
This marries the two universes.
That sounds problematic itself. But I do want to remind you that we do have the Echo Boomers promotion going on. If you want a digital copy of that movie, enter yourself to win by going to our Facebook page or Instagram or Twitter. Our handle is CriticsPod. There's a picture of the pinned to the top of all of our social media. Michael Shannon stars Patrick Schwarzenegger. Click on the link, like it, and leave a comment. You'll be entered as a chance to win a digital copy of the movie. It's out now. So if you want to watch it, you can. We will possibly talk about it once this promotion ends. But yeah, check out Echo Boomers right now if you're interested. Otherwise, are you interested in a very quick game of Flick Chart?
Sure.
All right. Hurt Locker, Now You See Me.
Hurt Locker.
Agreed. Moneyball, Mad Max, 1979. Moneyball. Absolutely. March of the Penguins, The Search, 1948. I've never heard of that.
I don't think I've seen The Search.
Neither have I. March of the Penguins, 10,000 BC.
March of the Penguins, 10,000 BC sucks.
Absolutely. Parent Trap with Lindsay Lohan or Aliens, 1986.
Aliens.
I suppose. Pacific Rim, Coraline.
Coraline. I love Coraline.
Mm-hmm. Serendipity, Jackass the Movie. Oh, sorry, Josh.
Jackass.
Agreed. Prometheus, Up.
Up.
Man, it's just anti-Josh this week.
Flick Chart heard we were inviting him back.
Life of Pi, Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring.
Life of Pi.
In fairness, he likes the movies that are winning, but still. Let's see. Pink Flamingos, Black Panther.
Black Panther.
Never seen Pink Flamingos, but I will go with Black Panther. I'll assume it's better.
A guy in a dress eats shit. If that helps you. Right. Actual feces.
Well, now I'm torn. The 40-year-old virgin being John Malkovich.
That's a tough one. Wow.
It's back to
those two movies are great. It's
the better movie versus the movie you'd watch.
40-year-old virgin.
Oh, man. I figured I'd go with that one. I guess that wins. For sure, that'd be a coin flip. Outsiders, Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring.
Outsiders, it's shorter. Yeah,
I agree. War Machine, 2017. Hellboy 2, The Golden Army.
What's War Machine? I don't remember.
Brad Pitt, Netflix movie? I don't think we talked about it on the podcast, did we?
Oh, I did see it, yeah. That was the one where, yeah, it's the Iraq War one.
Is it better than Hellboy 2?
Anything's better than Hellboy 2. Well, no, Hellboy 2 is, I guess, probably the best of the Hellboy movies. I'm thinking of Hellboy, the remake. Now, still, I would still take War Machine. I don't care for any of the Hellboy movies. But Hellboy 2 is probably the best of them.
Possession, 1981, Mighty Ducks 2.
Oh, Possession is what? I don't remember.
No idea, 1981. I'll just reset it. Mighty Ducks 2, 500 Days of Summer.
500 Days of Summer. I love that movie.
Mortal Kombat, Deep Blue Sea.
Deep Blue Sea.
Ordinary People, True Lies.
Ordinary People, I guess.
Yeah. Whiplash, National Treasure, Book of Secrets.
Whiplash.
The Untamable Whiskers, 1904. You ever heard of that one?
I might have missed that one.
When did they start making movies? All right, here we go. From Justin to Kelly, Shooter.
Shooter.
Last King.
They're both terrible, but Last terrible King, in different ways.
Last King of Scotland, Stigmata.
Last King of Scotland. I don't want to watch either of them.
Blade Trinity, Ratatouille.
Ratatouille, absolutely.
Godfather 2, Michael Clayton.
Godfather 2, but I respect Michael Clayton.
Yes. Alice in Wonderland, 2010, Runaway Bride.
Oh, God, that's brutal. That is brutal. Oh, Runaway Bride, but man. Oh.
Moana, Scream 3.
Moana. Scream 3 sucks.
Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Clash of the Titans, 2010.
Yeah, I think we...
Yeah. Zombieland, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
Zombieland.
All right. Last Action Hero, Coraline.
Coraline.
Agreed. Batman, Small Soldiers, 1989 Batman.
Batman.
Every Batman small.
I would take Batman 66 over.
Batman Begins, The Fugitive.
Why do they always give us Batman Begins every time? Batman Begins.
Agreed. Nine, or The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Nine, I think, is a... I don't know if it's Tim Burton, but Tim Burton related cartoon.
Yeah, I think Timberback Mambabov made it. Timberback Mambabov made it. yeah, that one is better.
Yeah. Arachnophobia, Free Willy, whales or spiders?
I don't know. I don't know.